Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Come Out of Her My People show. I'm your host, Mark Collin. As you no doubt know, this is the show where we talk about exactly that, not only the how-to, but the why and some of the principles that would have once, at least, connected constitutional law, the common law, the supreme law of the land, and the really supreme law, the scripture, the things that were laid down to us in genuine print in the Bible. And range from the Ten Commandments to the entire structure of the book, which is all about teaching and instruction for us. In any case, there ought to be a lot of overlap. There certainly used to be. And we're going to talk today about some of the elements and the really important reasons why, as that gets lost, bad things happen, I guess is probably an oversimplified way to put it. I've actually got a title for this show as well, and it's going to harken back to a phrase you've probably heard, life, liberty, and property, and ask the question, well, why not? Among other things, why is it when the founders wrote the Declaration of Independence, they said, well, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and property. Well, that was the original draft, evidently, but it was changed for a couple of reasons. Among them, well, it's maybe more poetic, and might even avoid a perception that it has to do with slavery, which Jefferson abhorred, of course. But it went from life, liberty, and property to the now famous phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But there's another reason, I contend, why life, liberty, and property wasn't necessarily the most poetic way to put it, because at one point, at least, it was also so obvious. Jefferson notes that it harkens back to people like John Locke and writings that predated all of the founders. There were, of course, a lot of philosophical discussions during the time. But ultimately, I think everybody in that era realized that what they were talking about was life, liberty, and property, and do we really have to say it? Because maybe there are some other things that we want to emphasize here. The rest of the Constitution, the Declaration, goes on to make the point about property in no uncertain terms. So if anything, I think what's been missing, what's lost, is the idea that what would have once been considered, well, self-evident, obvious, the importance of life, liberty, and property, has not gotten to the point where we have blithering idiots dumbed down in the public cesspools don't have a clue what any of that means. In other words, I asked the question, why not life, liberty, and property? Because it's no longer true that it's a basic understanding, that it's obvious, and it should be. By the way, I've used the term before. There are certain things that are called maxims of law, fundamental principles. Again, self-evident truths. And the idea of property and that a person has the right to themselves. Their own body, for example, is their property. There were a lot of discussions dating all the way back to the Magna Carta about how kings would do things that were kind of nasty. They would dismember people, take away their limbs for offenses. Well, isn't that kind of like taking away their property? And there were a whole lot of reasons why, up to the founding era, various folks that wrote about things like life, liberty, and property said, you know, you can't just start dismembering people, taking away their bodies either. That is a part of them. That is their property, not your right to do so. Here's where I'm headed. Let's lay this out to begin with. Rights, the whole concept of rights, as opposed to what now passes for them, and as you know, what now is generally called a right isn't a right at all. Jefferson said, I have a right to nothing. Basically, which comes at the expense of another man. In other words, where he is forced to give up something of his life, liberty, and property in order to provide it. We live in a nation, folks, that just no longer even understands what real rights, God-given rights, are. I think that's obvious. But the, at least in part, thing that I want to explore right up front today has to do with how fundamental a genuine understanding of property is to our understanding of rights. If we don't know what property amounts to, if we don't really understand that we own ourselves, in other words, we're not slaves, that we have a right to a whole bunch of other things in the form of property, the right to defend ourselves, the right to have information and to have our own beliefs and to worship our God. In other words, a lot of things that were literally enshrined in the Bill of Rights. Matter of fact, I will go a step further and say, if you go through the Bill of Rights and try to understand what was being protected there, all of those things, one way or another, from freedom of speech and assembly and worship, to the right to keep and bear arms, to be free of illegal search and seizure, to the Third Amendment, which is often ignored, about quartering of troops in where? Your home, your property. And all of the rest of them, the protections of the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, all have to do with protecting a fundamental idea of property, which is, in fact, associated with those God-given rights. Now, one other thing. When I say the word property today, you're going to hear, if you go back and look at history and study the writings of people like Locke and Jefferson and the various other founders and those that preceded them even, you'll see a lot of discussion about the property. And oftentimes they refer to either a person's body or their personal possessions. That's one of the terms that's used. Or even things like land. I usually, when I have discussed this in the past, and I'll spend a little bit of time on it in a few minutes, but have made reference to, well, once upon a time, people actually owned land in the formerly free United States of America. I know that comes as a shock. Well, don't I own my home? Don't I own the land? Well, actually, do you have the mineral rights? Do you have the water rights? Can you prevent somebody from coming on it and charging you rent for what you thought was your property? Yeah, property taxes. Find out who you're paying the rent to. That'll show you who the real owner is. Once upon a time, though, there was a concept in the common law called allodium. A-L-L-O-D-I-U-M. You'll see it referred to in other ways, too. It's also called in the law dictionaries fee simple absolute. But try this on for size. See how far we've passed from the idea of real ownership of land. Used to be, if you owned a piece of property, you could build on it. Want to build a house? Build on it. Want to survey it and put up a fence? Do it. It's yours, isn't it? You want to dig a septic system? You want to dig a pond? You want to have animals on your land? Well, is it your land or not? If it's not, maybe you have to go to some zoning commission and ask permission. Maybe you have to ask some other group, can I paint my house? What color can I paint my house? And a whole bunch of other questions that the founders would have said, come on, you're not a free person. You don't own squat. Once upon a time, there were sayings in the founding era, like, no king but King Jesus. Well, the king, as you probably remember, in feudal times, owned all the land. And the idea of the feudal lords and duchesses and barons and all those other titles of feudal, well, not really ownership, but the right to use the land, dated to the concept of the king. The king was the actual owner, and he would give the various lords permission down the chain to have a right to use some of his land, and he in turn, that feudal lord, could sublet, basically, other parts of it. But that was the nature of the feudal system. Nobody owned the land except the sovereign, the king. And in America, there was a whole different concept. Fee simple absolute, allodium, a man's home and his castle. And by the way, in the castle, he can defend himself too. Unlike the feudal serfs, who weren't allowed to defend themselves, even to have swords or things like chainmail, armor, if you weren't a lord, or at least a knight, you didn't have any of those so-called rights. All of this leads me to a line that I'm going to start off with when it comes to a look back at the history from James Madison in the Virginia Convention on the Ratification of the Constitution, where he said the following. See if this doesn't make sense and comport with what we're talking about. I believe, said Madison, there are more instances of the abridgment of the rights of the people by the gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. You've heard me quote the line that I love from The Wicked Witch of the West and The Wizard of Oz. These things must be done delicately. And that's indeed how they have destroyed the right to life, liberty, and in particular, property. Let me quote a couple other things from John Locke as well when it came right down to it. Of course, he is the one that's generally credited with making this concept so well known during the Revolutionary era. Locke established that private property is absolutely essential for liberty. He wrote, "Every man has a property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself." Then furthermore, he said, "The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his." And he goes on to draw some other conclusions. By the way, this came from some of his writings, particularly the second treatise on government. "The great and chief ends," he said, "therefore, of men uniting into commonwealths, a.k.a. governments, and putting themselves under government, is the preservation of their property." Well, there you can see where the concept of the purpose of governments is to secure these rights, right out of the Declaration. Locke insisted that people, not rulers, are the real sovereigns, and government, he wrote, can never have a power to take to themselves the whole or any part of the subject's property without their own consent. For this would be, in effect, to leave them no property at all. And then he goes on to say things like taxes, taxing the property of the people without their consent, given by themselves or their deputies, their representatives. All of this has to do with some other things that are fundamentally enshrined in the Constitution, like the right to contract. That, too, is mentioned more than once in there. But the idea is real similar, folks, to what the Scriptures point out over and over again. If you read the stories, if you see what happens with Abraham, if you see what happens with the land, if you see how he is so careful to purchase land and have it recorded in the book of Genesis, a place to bury Sarah, all of the fundamental principles, and we've talked about this many times on this show, that are outlined in the, well, first the books of the Bible, the Torah, later in Deuteronomy, where they're re-summarized again. And then following that in the common law, Blackstone's commentaries, and a lot of things that were literally enshrined in the Constitution. All of this is consistent with and very much, well, right smack out of the pages of Scripture. Speaking of which, I guess I'll ask one more question up front. I was thinking about using this as a summary, but it's a better introduction to where we're at, because I hear people misquote this one all the time. There's a famous story in the Bible from the pages of the Apostolic Writings, a.k.a. the New Testament. Interestingly, it appears in three different places, almost word for word the same. And I'll give you those in just a minute, but I'm going to read at least the summary out of Matthew chapter 22, verse 21. So think about Matthew 22, 22. You can come pretty close to where it begins. This basically is where the religious potentates of the time, the Pharisees, plotted against him. And then they said, hey, we got this clever question for you. A teacher, we know you're true. You teach the way of Elohim in truth. And you don't regard the persons of men. In other words, you're not beholden to somebody just because they have a high, mighty title. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now, he recognized this, it says, as a trap. And so why do you test me, you hypocrites? And here is where he gets very clever and leaves us with a couple of really good answers and several even more important questions, I'm going to suggest. Show me the tax money. In other words, show me what passes for money here. Well, they bring him a denarius, and he says to them, whose image and inscription are on this? Well, they said to him, Caesar's. And everybody knows the next line, right? All right, he said, quote, render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto Elohim the things that are Elohim's. Okay. So I'm going to ask a question, because oftentimes I think people miss the larger point here. Yes, it's about fake money. Now, nowadays, of course, that denarius, which was continually, even by that time, but it really accelerated thereafter, being devalued, watered down, corrupted with base metals and so forth. In other words, its silver content went down steadily, and as a result, we saw inflation. Today, of course, we don't have even anything remotely approaching silver, which is the biblical definition of money. Money is silver. Kesef in the Hebrew. It's the very same word for money and for silver, because they are the same thing. And as I've always pointed out, in the Constitution, back when we had one, it says several times, more than once, that money is in fact gold or silver. Nothing but gold or silver coin, or be made a tender in payment of debt. All of this, although we do have mortgage debt money and so forth too, there's a consistent pattern here. But the bigger understanding is this. I think those that say, oh, well, see, if Caesar has the money, then you gotta pay Caesar's taxes. That's not, note, what the Mashiach is saying. I contend that another element that gets missed all the time is he's asking essentially us to ask the bigger question here. Whose image and inscription is this? All right. Well, then render unto Caesar that which is his. And furthermore, hey, who are you? More importantly, whose are you? Yes, according to John Locke and the founders, it is important. We understand that we own ourselves, but we ourselves have a creator, and we are ultimately his, and the scripture makes that point clear too. We forget that, and we miss a whole bunch of the remaining principles here. Now, I mentioned the right to contract. You can check out places like Article 1, Section 10, and the Fifth Amendment. And the whole idea of life, liberty, and property, and people are not to be deprived of it. The 14th Amendment was supposed to do likewise, and in fact, it ends up producing a whole different kind of a bondage. We've talked about that as well. There's one other element I'll lay out, at least in terms of a constitutional argument that we've seen happen over the years that you'll often find when it comes to this idea of life, liberty, and property. Again, antithetical to it. Mostly post-war between the states, the war to prevent Southern independence, and it has to do with what's called the police power of the almighty state. The police power. Think about that. What does the almighty state have? Well, it seems to have a power that really isn't in the Constitution anywhere to commit thievery when it suits them, to commit kidnapping when it suits them, breaking and entering when it suits them. Violations of God's law, the Ten Commandments, and all kinds of other things in that book of instruction, just about any time the almighty state wills it, by giving somebody a badge and a gun and declaring that they're now above the law. The whole point of democracy, of course, is that 51% can violate the life, liberty, and property of the remaining 49% any time they can get together enough of a vote to do it. I often point out that if you go through Scripture and ask yourself the question, how does the creator of the universe seem to feel about democracy and the idea that, well, a majority vote can override God? Answer, he's not real keen on it. I will usually note that if you search out and look for the stories, you'll find arguably three places where there looks like something approaching a vote. And if we look at those three votes in the Bible, it kind of begins to give us a pattern. First one, obviously, in, the Exodus time frame, when you have 10 people having surveyed the land, spied out the land, come back and give a bad report, right? And as you know, the vote was 10-2. Joshua and Caleb lost that, and everybody who participated, even indirectly, in that vote, their carcasses died there in the wilderness. You can look ahead to 1 Samuel chapter 8. There's another vote there. The people said, hey, give us king like all the other nations. Give us a good-looking tall dude. And they got King Saul. Of course, not the best choice. They were warned. The prophet warned them, here's what the king will do. And indeed, people now think that's an excuse. But indeed, over the years, kings have done all those bad things that they were warned about. And then, of course, if you fast forward way on down through the rest of the book, you'll find arguably the final and probably most famous example of a vote in Scripture, and a fellow named Barabbas won that one. Okay, I think all of those tend to make the point, though. The idea that democracy overrides the law, whether we're talking about the Bill of Rights, because people vote to take away your guns, or your right to freedom of assembly, speech, worship, or you name it, or that you don't have a right to privacy, or that you don't have a right to be secure in your persons, houses, papers, and effects, or any of those other things that no longer matter in post-constitutional America. There you go. All right, now there's another element to this privacy thing that I want to focus on here. We'll come back to this in the second half and go to some of the other important elements as well. But I saw this actually today, and I thought about leading off with it because it was so reprehensible. A lot of you know, if you've heard me talk about the occasional cortex, Alexandria occasional cortex, and she's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Folks, this is arguably the dumbest person ever to infest the halls of Congress. But in this particular case, a tweet the other day that was pointed out by Tom Woods, I'm sure there were lots of others that saw it, and you'll see why in a second, demonstrates why this topic today about life, liberty, and property is so important. because it's so absolutely, well, mistaught. The occasional cortex, the idiot one, wrote the following, and I'm trying to be as kind as I can here, folks. Quote, croissants at LaGuardia, the airport there in New York, are going for $7 a piece. She capitalized it. I guess she can use the caps key. Yet some people think getting a whole hour of personal dedicated human labor for $15 is too expensive? Question mark, question mark. Say what? Well, I'm going to say this. It's an indictment of an entire once free nation that a brainless, maleducated, clueless moron like this is even allowed to lie about an oath that she took to preserve, protect, and defend a constitution, a document that she obviously hasn't ever read, but worse still, obviously detests anyway. Some people think getting a whole hour of personal dedicated human labor for $15 is too expensive. Oh, I think if she had a brain, she'd be talking about the unconstitutional usurpation of property called the minimum wage. It's also a violation of everything that the, well, Constitution allows the central government to do. But she misses the whole point. As Tom Woods put it, every aspect of the question she raises is completely wrong, brainless, wrong-headed. It's not about whether it's too expensive or not expensive enough. The point is, doesn't matter whether I think a job is worth more or less or it's too expensive. Doesn't matter whether the brainless one thinks so either. It's not up to her. The concept of a free market, Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, says a job is worth what somebody is willing to agree contractually, voluntarily, as free people, that it's worth. If I'm willing to pay $4 to have my porch cleaned, but not $10, I should be able, in a free society, if I actually owned my body, the fruits of my labors, if the scriptures had anything to say about it, I should be able to say, well, I choose to either participate in this contractual exchange or not. Big Brother says, oh, no, no, you can't. You cannot hire somebody for less than a certain amount. Well, that means I don't get it done, or I have to do it myself, and if I don't have time, it doesn't get done. On the other hand, sadly, if there's somebody who would like the work and would be more than willing to have the $4, they too are being deprived. So here's Big Brother depriving everybody of their property in the name of, oh, some egalitarian idiocy about what's too expensive and what's not. Says who? Who are we talking about that owns the right to their labor on both hands? Those that voluntarily enter into contract as a buyer and or a seller. Well, we know where it's headed, right? Eventually, Big Brother's going to say you won't be able to do either without our mark. So for all of those reasons, the whole concept here of, essentially this socialist, this communist, this anti-property mentality, this anti-rights mentality that is now so permeating our society that we don't even have a clue anymore what life, liberty, and property once meant, and ironically, even though the founders didn't want to give a perception that they were supporting slavery by using that terminology, it didn't sound as poetic. What we're seeing nowadays are a whole bunch of people who, know it or not, have been gradually turned into slaves to an almighty state, back into a feudal system, as they lose the rights to property, the right to ownership of things that were once protected by the, Second Amendment, for example. If you can start with the single piece of property that shall not be infringed, what limits are there? Answer, none. And that includes your body. I've made this comment before, too. It really bugs me that women talk about my body, my choice. Well, if it's your body, your choice, why can't you defend it against rape with a gun? Who is the real owner of a body that you can't protect? All you can do is kill something else, but you can't protect your own body. Something is horribly wrong here, folks, and the problem is people no longer even recognize how far we've come from the fundamental principles and understandings that once undergirded the entire rule of law. But we'll be right back.
Yesterday, then I'll get on my knees and pray. wonder, I can't think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing.
Welcome back to the second half of the Come Out of Her My People show. I'm your host, Mark Hall. Today we're talking about a show that I've given the title, Why Not? Life, Liberty, and Property, referring to the Declaration, which talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And basically the implication is there, pursuit of happiness and the ability to own property, and that includes yourself. And literally everything that goes with it, the right to the labor of your hands, the right to protect yourself, and your property, and your family, and so forth. All of those things are so fundamental to an understanding of what was once the supreme law of the land and comes right smack out of Scripture that as we've missed it, lost it, and become so dumbed down, like the occasional cortexes of the world are trying to prove to us, that we don't understand where our rights come from, what rights even are anymore, or what the point of property even is anymore, because the socialists would have you believe, oh, there's a social contract, and all of that overrides anything that the God of the Bible, whom we don't want to allow into the schools or into the halls of Congress, would have had to say about it anyway. Well, after all of that, and when we went to the bottom of the hour, I was referring briefly at least to this idea of, well, an anti-property concept, an anti-constitutional concept. Again, go to the Article 1, Sections 7, 8, 9, and 10 of the Constitution, primarily Section 8. You'll see the things that the central government has the power to say anything at all about. And the minimum wage, or education, or so many things that Big Brother now thinks it needs, or has at least the right to control the lives of the slaves who don't own themselves anymore, obviously. Well, all of those things make the point very clearly. Now, minimum wage, again, is not in there. And it does, I think, really not matter so much that the effects are so negative, but in truth they are. It's kind of like how gun control results in more gun-free killing zones and a hell of a lot more so-called gun violence deaths than we ever have had in this country's history before, back when people had God-given rights and knew that they had, therefore, responsibilities to the God who gave them life and that liberty. We don't have anything like that today. Well, the same thing's true with minimum wage laws. What do we have? We have inflation. We have impediments to contract to businesses. We end up having jobs being shipped overseas. All kinds of obvious things. Here's just one simple one. As the minimum wage is going up, small business layoffs are going into what's being called a payroll tsunami, as businesses literally close their doors because they can't comply, they can't make a profit, they can't stay in business, they can't provide anybody with jobs at rates that aren't set by the free market. Interestingly, the same idiot from New York, Representative Occasional Cortex, swung by and tweeted about it to the Union Square coffee shop where she used to work. Now, this is what's interesting, that the brainless disconnect here. She tweeted the following. The restaurant I used to work at is closing its doors. I swung by to say hi one last time and kid around and blah-de-blah-de-blah. What she failed to mention to her ignorant followers is that the popular coffee shop was shuttering its doors permanently because it couldn't afford the $15 minimum wage that Ocasio-Cortex has gone on to so strongly support. The owner told the New York Post, the rents are very high, and now the minimum wage is going up. We have a huge number of employees, and they basically just couldn't keep the doors open. Hey, but what the heck? It's not the consequences that matter, right? It's whether or not we can have our will rather than some God of the Bible or some concept of a set of principles embodied in a Declaration of Independence or even the idea of life, liberty, and property. Let me go to a slightly larger understanding here, because it's not just things like property rights and land. I've got an interesting article that I was originally intending to spend more time on than I now will, but I'll at least give you the bottom line as we talk about the land aspect of property. The Source of U.S. Exceptionalism wrote a piece that I came up with from Andrew Linklater, actually a few years old, is the concept of property. And he points to the original land survey in America, saying this a late 18th century thing, and it actually went on afterwards for, well, several hundred years. It's still in a way in progress. 1785, a fellow named Thomas Hutchins and a team of surveyors first unrolled a 22-yard chain, began to measure out the wilderness. And as the country grew, they and their successors moved on and measured out and surveyed the entire property of what became the North American United States of America. It would be easy to miss the significance, says the author of what he was doing, but Hutchins was making it possible for Americans to own their own country. And he goes through a whole lot of histories, page after page. It's kind of fascinating, but basically, the idea is that west of the Appalachians, in order to realize the value of this vast uncharted territory, it had to be measured out and mapped and then sold by the fledgling government for cash. This method of transformation was unique, and it produced a land-owning society like no other. And he goes on to describe the task and the monumental scope of it. They surveyed over 3 million square miles. In the course of more than two centuries subsequently, the survey continues with ever-growing accuracy. Hutchins and his followers covered almost all of the U.S. They took lengthy tracks through thick forest, planting markers across the mountains, building mounds and long lines over prairie and desert, creating a grid of almost 1 million squares, each one 6 miles by six. And as you know, those miles were then divided down to where we have a square mile, 640 acres, and they all the subsequent history of 40 acres and a mule, and the idea of all of the people of the land, unlike just the king, would literally be able to become landowners. The achievement was breathtaking, but it's dwarfed by the economic and social consequences of transferring over 1 billion acres from public to private ownership. Everybody from gold miners and their claims to the feuds of cowboys and farmers, homesteads, and so forth, had a stake in all of this. He talks about the feudal understanding that I've already kind of mentioned, and all of the rest of the history. But basically, it is quite an achievement, and it was this that set the United States of America apart. And as a matter of fact, I want to mention one line here from a Peruvian author and economist named Hernando de Soto, who wrote a book called The Mystery of Capital, and argues that the most important step towards rescuing the third world from the kind of poverty that communism and the similar ideologies have enmeshed it in would be the creation of a similar framework of property, giving the occupants of shanty towns title to the land they live on. In Europe, of course, you don't have a similar concept. It still has a lot of feudal roots. In 1813, traveler and radical John Mellish wrote, "Every industrious citizen of the United States has the power to become a freeholder, and the land being purely his own, setting of no limits to his prosperity. No proud tyrant can lord it over him." Ultimately, says the author, he makes a pretty good case, this is one of the things that helped America to be what it is. And it's all part and parcel of the same attitude and ideology that people have a right to own themselves, the work of their hands, and yes, the land that they're able to do it on. Mention some other things. We'll go to these threads as well. Subtitle, Why Not Life, Liberty, and Property? Well, among other things that are all impacted, even if we don't understand it, not just rights, things like guns, obviously, property that was once, at least, when we had one, protected by the Constitution, the Second Amendment. You start there, you can get rid of all the rest of it. How about vaccinations? There's a lot of discussion nowadays. I've seen a number of pieces, Mike Adams, Natural News, kind of at the vanguard of that, pointing out all of the usurpations, because you don't own your own body, don't you know? In Brooklyn, in the People's Republic of New York, there are counties where the alleged measles epidemic now, even though it turns out that the people that are getting the measles are by and large, and to a large extent, having already been vaccinated for it. Isn't that funny? Yeah, live virus vaccines will do that, folks. There's actually a possibility of catching the thing you're supposed to be vaccinated against. It's one of many reasons why there are a lot of people that have, well, at least the concept of ownership of their own bodies, and the control, the guardianship of the children that the Creator has given to them. Say, no, no, I don't know what's in this thing, or sometimes I do know what's in it. Thimerosal, mercury, adjuvants, various kinds of live viruses, and who knows what else, from fetal cells to monkey pox. Don't want to inject that in my body. I read the list. I understand the side effects. I understand some of the mathematics. Folks, I am among those who would now be called a vaccine denier. Not in every case, absolutely, but when it comes to the science, it's pretty darn clear. I certainly wouldn't inject my children, had I any today, with things that have been demonstrated to result in a huge increase in autism. Kids are better off, in my personal opinion, if they suffer from the childhood diseases of mumps and measles and similar things, chicken pox. Because once you've had them, isn't it amazing? The God of the universe designed us so we don't get them again. Helps to strengthen our immune system. Well, all of that gets lost. But the point is, Big Brother doesn't want you to have the right to your own property, and that would be your body. In New York, they are telling people, we will quarantine. No, not the ones that are sick, like actually used to be done in the interest of public health. We're going to punish those who know better, the vaccine deniers, by quarantining them, even though they're not sick and probably less likely to get so, because it's all about information. You see, you are property. You're not your own property. You're the state's property. That's why they can tell you you don't have a right to travel. And if we feel like it, you slave you, under the police powers, we might just strap you to a gurney, take your blood, take your DNA. We'll certainly take your fingerprints. We can voice print you and face print you. Oh, and we'll fill you full of anything we blankety blank and well feel like it too. Tell you it's for your own good. Even if it ends up killing you, hey, we'll lie about that as well. So Mike Adams has been writing a lot about this. Here's one typical story of late. Facebook, or to Facebook as I like to refer to it, the socialist media platform, has banned all content having to do with vaccine awareness, including facts, things like the ingredients in various vaccines, the injuries they might cause, and the collusion of industry and Brother to prevent you, along with to Facebook, from finding out about it. As we warned, he said, the tech giants are now moving aggressively to ban all speech that contradicts whatever the official narrative is. And it's decided to be the truth with the stamp of approval of the corrupt establishment. Last week, Facebook has banned all content that questions the official dogma on vaccines, which insists that vaccines have never harmed anyone, a hilarious lie, he says, that they contain only safe ingredients, a blatant deception, and that they always work on everyone, another laughable lie. And he goes on and on and on. But I think all of this makes the point. Do they have the right to information? Do they have the right to debate? Hey, here's one. Do they have the right to be wrong? Can they even be idiots like the occasional Cortex? Well, now, there's a difference. I guess if people want to sit on the floor of Congress and lie, I have a personal problem with that. I'll admit that. I think that was the reason why the founders put that oath in place, saying they're supposed to say this, presidents in particular, to preserve and protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. The idea was to keep the domestic enemies out of a body that claimed to represent people that it, in fact, hates and wants to take away their God-given rights. Remember, they don't ascribe to the same self-evident truths that once built the greatest nation on planet Earth. And we're seeing the undeniable effects of all of that. The vaccine is just one element of it. Let me read one more quote. Now, I've used this one a couple times over the last few weeks, but this comes from James Madison, same guy that talked about abridgment of the rights of the people by silent and gradual encroachments. He wrote the following, and this too. Would that we had listened to it 50, 100 years ago. It is proper, said the guy who was a president in the early 1800s, it is proper to take alarm at the first experiment on our liberties. We hold this prudent jealousy to be the first duty of citizens and one of the noblest characteristics of the late revolution. The freemen of America, he said, did not wait until usurped power had strengthened itself by exercise and entangled the question in precedence. They saw all the consequences in the principle, and they avoided the consequences by denying the principle. We revere this lesson too much to forget it. Now here we are, folks, having forgotten the lesson, ignored the consequences of, well, principles that are being turned on their head, and now suffering the consequences. It's why I think this show and this concept is so vital to our basic understanding. Life, liberty, and property. No more. We literally have a land where we have a whole bunch of dumbed down, ignorant idiots, like that Congress critter from New York. And I hate to even use that terminology. This woman doesn't deserve. All of those people, folks, who will not put their hand on the Bible and honestly swear to preserve and protect and defend a Constitution against enemies that include themselves, enemies domestic, shouldn't be there. They have no right to the claim a representative. What are they doing? They're literally making war upon the people of the United States, of the states. Somebody comes and wants to take away your right to life, to liberty, to property, to defend that against the likes of them, to say not just no, but hell no to what they want to do to you. That's treason. And we're rapidly seeing all of the implications of an experiment upon our liberties, because this prudent jealousy, the first duty of citizens, has been ignored, denied, lied about, covered up, to the point where most people now are so dumbed down, like the occasional cortex, they don't even have a clue what the Constitution was set up to protect and defend against. In other words, them, on so many levels. All right. Well, I want to close with a couple of comments from a piece that pretty much emphasizes this from an economic standpoint, written by Brandon Smith. It's called The Reasons Behind the Relentless Ideological Onslaught Against Free Markets. And, of course, as I've pointed out before, do we still have capitalism? I don't think most people even understand what capitalism is anymore. But I'll tell you one thing for sure. You cannot have free markets, much less whatever capitalism once was, with crooked money, with dishonest weights and measures. We have not had a system of capitalism, arguably, for decades, perhaps 100 years. It started back in 1913 with the founding of the Federal Reserve, unconstitutional in the extreme, and the ability of an unconstitutional public-private partnership to do that which the Congress was never given the authority to do, which is to print money. They were supposed to regulate the value of coin by defining how much silver, for example, is in a dollar, and so forth. And once upon a time, they did. Now we don't have any. That's wrong and unconstitutional. The only time free markets cause trouble, says Brandon Smith, is when they're manipulated or misused by elitists, or as we've seen in New York, idiots, seeking to turn them into something other than free markets. And there's a lot of reasons for this, and he points out a number. I've already pointed out another, the idea of fiat, dishonest weights and measures, absolutely prohibited in Scripture and the Constitution. As a matter of fact, Scripture says to do so brings a curse. Says Brandon Smith, prior to the 20th century, domestic trade in the U.S. was loosely, if at all, regulated. The income tax didn't exist, except for a trial run during the Civil War that was eventually repealed. There was no permanent central bank. When I was a kid in high school, I was always confused by why there was so much discussion in the history books, that was back then, of course, about a central bank. Andy Jackson, right? You're a den of vipers, and by God, he said, I will root you out, as he got rid of an earlier experiment. And then along came the creature from Jekyll Island, as G. Edward Griffin put it, and we've had this nasty, evil central bank destroying the economy and the rule of law ever since. Well, says Smith, it's not fair to say corruption in business didn't exist pre-20th century. It certainly did, and even then it was fueled by collusion between Big Brother and the public-private partners, business moguls, with the aid of government, the very opposite of free markets, such criminal monopolies, cartels, they were called, trusts, back in the early part of the 1900s, came to rule vast areas. And then, of course, the banking trusts went ahead and argued, oh, we're going to prevent the very banking trusts that are creating the central bank from being able to do it. It was a bill of goods. He talks about corporations, and I've mentioned this any number of times, defined by their corporate charter, corporate personhood, derived from the exploitation of the 14th Amendment. And corporations and the idea of corporate personhood undermined the biblical concept, now this is me diverging from the text a bit here, of liability. If a person did something bad, something evil, and cost somebody their eye or their life, the concept of an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth in Scripture wasn't you blind the person. I like to teach it this way. Think about if your negligence resulted in somebody losing an eye or a hand, the biblical principle is to make them whole again. Well, you can't restore their eye or their hand. So what is measure for measure the appropriate response? Well, ask yourself the question. How much would you pay to keep your eye or your hand? You see the point? This is overlooked by those who would try to turn the Bible on its head. It's not about poking out somebody's eye. That doesn't help anybody. But it is about asking the person, or at least asking the question metaphorically, what is your eye worth to you? Well, that's what it ought to be worth to that poor guy that you, by your negligence or evil act, have damaged. Make it right. No, you don't put him in prison. That doesn't help anybody. That's not a biblical solution either. But measure for measure, you make it right. You restore. And if that even necessitated selling the person into bond service for up to 7 years, well, not forever like the IRS does, then that was what would happen. Now, though, we have corporate personhood, or a company with unlimited life. Yeah, you can be like God. You will not die. A corporate chartered entity can be sued as a legal person in civil court, but you can't very well kill a corporation, at least not in the sense that you can kill a living, breathing person with a soul now, can you? And that's true even if they were directly involved in the commission of a crime. No wonder things have gone so far out of hand. This is corporate governorship. This is socialism. This is the exact antithesis of free markets, says Brandon Smith. And I would go one step further and say, hey, truly the public-private partnership isn't mere socialism. It's the Nazi version, national socialism. It's fascism. It's the nature of a public private partnership. And it's one of the many reasons why, if we step back and look and see what's gone on here, we have come so far from a common law based on the principles of Scripture, based on the ideas of life, liberty, and property. Now you have corporations that own things where people, living, breathing individuals with a soul, cannot. Does anything about that strike you as wrong? Smith goes on to talk about, hey, yeah, where is all this headed? Obviously, the cashless society. Guess who will run that? Guess who will have complete control? And guess who won't be able to buy or sell without taking some kind of a mark from the coming beast system? He asks some other questions that we'll close with. Could evil companies like Monsanto, he doesn't spell it right, operate with impunity? You know, killing people in mass and destroying what God made to be seed, and instead putting their Terminator genes in it and contributing to literal contamination all across the land? Could they get away with that without the protection of government? Could the various big pharma companies inject people against their will and cause who knows how much death and destruction? Hey, given the vaccine courts and cover-ups, you don't know the answers. Could they do that without the explicit protection of government? In so many cases, the claim of the socialists, those that don't have a clue about what the Constitution once said, that, well, more government will save us from the very things that bad government and socialism and the public-private corporate partnerships have brought us, will somehow fix that which they have created. Einstein had it right. It's insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Well, folks, the point is, if we still understood the concepts in the Scripture of life, liberty, and property, if we knew what the founders fought and died for and pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor to one another for, we wouldn't treat it so casually, or yeah, so idiotically. Think about it. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.